I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, the day after the 80th anniversary of the five so-called permanent members of the Security Council establishing the United Nations. It's also 52 years since Egypt and Syria, armed with Russian weapons, shattered Israel's myth of invincibility at the end of the 1973 Arab-Israeli War. Today, of course, Britain, the EU and the USA have armed Israeli exceptionalism to unleash catastrophe right across this region, expanding the violence into Qatar, Tunisia, Lebanon, Yemen, Iraq, Syria and Iran. Trump's attempt at pausing the Gaza genocide was betrayed within a week of his visit to Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. This week, Trump's VP J.D. Vance was dispatched to an Israel violating the U.S. plan with bombs and again using food as a weapon. This after his son-in-law, family friend of Netanyahu, Jared Kushner, explained on television how using a nuclear weapon on a people to ethnically cleanse them was not genocide. In Montreal again, his ex-office of the UN Special Envoy for Syria official and co-editor of Jadalia magazine, Muin Rabbani. Muin, thanks so much for coming back on Going Underground. It's been more than a year, and what a tragic year it's been for this region. You've said the turning point in the genocide was the Israeli bombing of Qatar. Before we get to the downsides, obviously scores of Palestinians being killed during the so-called truce that was announced in Sharm el-Sheikh. Just can you imagine the kind of bravery that Trump has shown, members of the Trump administration has shown? Can you ever imagine that during the Biden part of the genocide, Genocide Joe and Holocaust Harris and the Democrats?
Well, I'm not sure I would refer to the Trump officials involved in this sordid affair as brave or courageous. But certainly they have gone further than was ever conceivable under Biden. If we remember, there was a ceasefire proposal on the table every single day of the Biden administration's tenure. What would typically happen is that at some point Hamas would accept the proposal, then Israel would be allowed to introduce new terms or to reject it, and then Biden, Blinken, and their various spokesmen would be trotted out to say, the reason we don't have a ceasefire is because Israel has accepted it, but Hamas continues to reject it. What we've seen now twice during the Trump administration is the U.S. essentially compelling Israel to accept a plan, but then really not having the attention span required to ensure that Israel actually complies with it, with its obligations. But nevertheless, it is, I think, fair to say that there is a fundamental difference between the approach of the Biden and Trump administration. During the Biden years, one could be forgiven for thinking that Israel is a superpower and the U.S. its proxy. I think Trump has made very clear that we're back to tradition where the U.S. issues the orders and Israel obeys instructions.
Mind you, perhaps I meant financially brave rather than morally brave, given that Marco Rubio, in between perhaps beginning a war on Venezuela, did receive $1 million from AIPAC. These are politicians funded to the hilt by Israeli sources. In fact, come to think of it, I mean, what did you personally think in Sharm el-Sheikh when he pointed out Miriam Adelson, the widow of the casino tycoon Sheldon Adelson, and said, you have $60 billion you kept on coming into the White House and telling, in effect, the American people that American democracy is subverted? What did you think when you saw it?
Well, one of the less unattractive characters of Trump is that he doesn't have any internal restraints that prevent him from saying in public what's not supposed to be enunciated. And in his talk before the Israeli parliament, he pointed out Miriam Adelson and basically said, you know, she gives a lot of money and she expects to be able to set policy as a result. And, you know, Israel aside, that's how the U.S. works. It's a plutocracy. Congress is an auction house before it is a legislative chamber where representatives are bought and sold on the open market. The highest bidder wins. And, you know, that applies to all lobbies. But it's well known that Israel has the largest portfolio of U.S. congressional representatives of any foreign state on Capitol Hill. I think Trump was just pointing out the obvious.
You're right. Adelson didn't go to Sharm el-Sheikh. It was in the Knesset, of course. The Knesset, which just passed a law days after Trump said that the West Bank mustn't be further occupied by Tel Aviv, by Netanyahu. The Knesset just passed a law enshrining Israeli sovereignty over the West Bank. So how do you characterize this push-me-pull-you sort of situation? I mean, Witkoff and Kushner saying it was like a nuclear bomb, but it's not genocide. What are the forces there that we should be looking for?
Well, I think the thing to understand about U.S. Middle East policy is, again, as I just noted, the U.S. takes the decisions and Israel obeys instructions. I think what we need to understand with specific respect to Palestine is that is one issue that is not of fundamental interest to the United States. It's not a national security concern.
There's a lot of money. It's not an important economic issue. A lot of money that's needed for infrastructure in the United States.
Well, that's certainly true. But the point I'm getting at is that on the issue of Palestine, Israel is given a lot of leeway to do as it pleases, because in contrast to other issues, it's not seen by Washington as something that fundamentally affects its foreign interests. But at the same time, whenever we do see a significant clash between U.S. and Israeli interests, it's invariably the U.S. That wins out. And when Israel is able to conduct policy that people see as somehow contradicting U.S. interests, that means either that the U.S. has passively acquiesced in that policy, or that it is actively supporting it, or in some cases, because Israel has been able to successfully manipulate Washington. But I think we need to get away from this idea that somehow the United States is an Israeli colony. And I think we need to understand that the U.S. needs to take a responsibility for its own foreign policy, for its own complicity in these abhorrent crimes, including now the Gaza genocide. Is Israel powerful in the U.S.? Certainly more powerful than any other foreign lobby. But Israel is not more powerful than the United States.
Yeah. So do you think the deal itself that was announced in Sharm el-Sheikh was set up to fail? That's how he got it accepted by the much more pro-Israeli elements than even Trump, because those forces knew Trump can talk as much as he likes. The deal will fail, and then the war can start on Iran.
Not necessarily. My impression is that the U.S. and the region as a whole are genuinely invested in this agreement and would like it in one way or another to succeed. Israel takes a very different approach. For Israel, an agreement consists of a number of phases. The first phase is the actual negotiation of any agreement. And we saw that when Netanyahu visited the White House in late September and managed to fundamentally alter the 21-point plan that had previously been agreed between Washington and a number of regional leaders. Then there is a second phase of negotiations where Israel negotiates the implementation of the agreement. And in those negotiations, it basically treats the provisions of the previous agreement irrelevant. So you once again begin negotiating from scratch. And once an agreement has been reached on the implementation of the agreement, there's then its implementation, in which Israel treats its previous commitments as preferences expressed by the other side rather than as binding obligations. And I think in this case, we need to understand that Israel was dragged into this agreement reluctantly, unwillingly even. And the only thing that is sustaining it is this U.S. pressure on Israel. But I think Israel is banking on the limited attention span of the Americans, and that once the Americans get diverted by other things, whether it's another foreign policy crisis like Venezuela or a domestic crisis like the government shutdown, Israel is confident that we'll be able to do as it pleases, and in so doing, enjoy at least passive U.S. acquiescence.
And as for Western Europe, it's just a sidebar. I mean, they just appeared there out of nowhere. People like Meloni and Starmer, nothing to do with it. Britain has a defense pact all through the genocide. They were implicated in spy flights from Cyprus, aiding the genocide. Europe has no role whatsoever. It's nothing to do with this.
Yes, I've never seen a block of countries work as assiduously to ensure its own irrelevance as the European Union, or the Europeans more generally, during the Gaza genocide. They've basically played the role of obedient puppy, of the submissive underling.
While sending the arms, and, I should say, to commit the genocide.
Well, that, I think that's part of the role. But in terms of any strategic autonomy, let alone seeking to influence the reality, they have worked night and day to ensure their total irrelevance. And we're seeing this now, not only with regard to Gaza, but at least as much so now with regard to Iran.
And why do you think that is?
It's a good question, and I'm not sure I have a precise answer for you. The closest I can come is that, as you know, Europe has some very fundamental differences with Washington, primarily regarding trade and tariffs and so on. And it's doing everything it can to mollify Washington, you know, to ensure Washington at least formally remains on board with European policy towards Ukraine and so on. A genocide isn't that big a deal for Europeans. I mean, you know, you'll be familiar with European history, so I don't need to elaborate on that. And in this case, as far as they're concerned, you know, they're not going to pick a fight with Washington over something that they see as important to the Americans, while they have much bigger fish to fry, like Ukraine, tariffs, etc.
Meanwhile, the Palestinian Authority, the deputy foreign minister, was on this program last week saying he's all up for a peace committee on which war criminal Tony Blair can be part of. Again, Palestinian Authority, a kind of irrelevance in some ways?
Very much so. I mean, you know, for the past 2 years, we've heard nary a peep from Ramallah and its leadership. They've, you know, it's almost like what's happening in Gaza was happening in Southeast Asia, or the tip of South America. And their dereliction of duty has really been shocking. And they're so eager and desperate to get back into the game that they're actually willing to play ball with Tony Blair, who, in addition to being, as you pointed out, a war criminal, after Iraq was also the Quartet special envoy in Palestine, and was universally detested by Palestinian officials. I'm not talking about Hamas. I'm talking about the Palestinian Authority. He was basically seen as an errand boy for the Israelis, and they couldn't stand him. But now, you know, it seems all is forgiven, and they're willing to praise him to the high heavens in a desperate attempt to get back into the game.
Moin Rabbani, I'll stop you there. More from the co-editor of Jadalia and former UN Syria advisor after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Muin Rabbani, co-editor of Jadalia. Muin, you were talking about the irrelevance of so many different parties to the genocide of our times, Western Europe, the Palestinian Authority. There's a lot of propaganda against GCC countries. Saudi Arabia called it for a genocide, even as the Americans were talking about Saudi Arabia joining the Abraham Accord. Similarly, Trump seemed to jump the gun, saying the UAE was all up for sending in forces to police the peace accord, which the UAE hastily said, no, there's no guarantees yet in place for anything like that to happen. And in fact, when Going Underground moved to Dubai a couple of years ago, Assad of Syria visited Dubai, Abu Dhabi, even his propaganda was saying, oh, you know, the GCC countries hate Assad, because Hamas did hate Assad. Do you think a lot of propaganda in NATO countries rests on this idea that the rich Gulf countries, the GCC countries, are somehow on board with the genocide when clearly, any just cursory look at the media in GCC countries is horrified about the genocide?
Well, it's certainly true that GCC governments, for that matter, all Arab governments, have played the role of inert spectator for 2 years. They have been quite satisfied to see Israel slaughtering Palestinians within their own homeland, and not really taking any active measures against Israel, whether severing diplomatic relations, trade sanctions, or any of the rest of it. And I think this reflects broader regional trends, particularly the increasingly large schism between rulers and ruled, concerns of Arab governments that if they give an inch to their own citizens, they'll take a mile.
I think many Arab governments would probably say that isn't true. There have been statements nonstop, just not being reported elsewhere. I mean, what I'm trying to get really, because you were an advisor at the UN in Syria, is it's all, of course, been very heartening to watch global opinion shift, opinion in the United States shift most noticeably and become pro-Palestinian. But many of these voices were the same voices who wanted to overthrow Assad and cheered on the overthrow of the Assad government in Syria. Do you think the genocide would have been possible without the overthrow of Assad of Syria?
Well, very much so, because it went on for a very long time before the ouster of Assad in Syria. But the point I was getting at is, yes, Arab public opinion, I think, is very clear on this issue, and that's why any further expansion of Arab-Israeli normalization agreements is going to be much more difficult now, because Arab leaders are going to require some meaningful, credible, irreversible progress on Palestinian rights and Palestinian self-determination to sign off. And Israel is more unwilling than ever to get it. And so how does Israel respond to this? Well, every time it's criticized and condemned, you see a typical statement, you know, that may be what they say in public, but in private, they're sending us perfumed love letters. That's how Israel has always approached this. You know, criticism is meaningless. Those who condemn us the loudest are actually those who support us the most, and so on.
But except for the bombing of Qatar, of course. Sorry, I do want to return to your Syria point in a second, but obviously the bombing of Qatar certainly alerted lots of governments in this region.
And that was a fundamental turning point, I believe, because, you know, first you had Trump's Riviera proposal in February, which basically sought to resolve Israel's Palestinian problem at Arab expense. Then you had the increasing expansion of Israeli aggression and destabilization throughout the region, you know, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, then Iran. But what distinguished Qatar is a close U.S. ally. And so you had the U.S. basically authorizing one U.S. ally to bomb another. And nobody in their right mind believes that the U.S. was taken by surprise or had absolutely no knowledge or could have done nothing to prevent this Israel.
Although it's a confused picture, isn't it? Confused picture, because that Witkoff and Kushner interview that I referenced earlier didn't match up with the story Trump told about how he rang Witkoff to call the Emir of Qatar in the middle of the night, when, of course, Witkoff said, I was asleep when the bombing of Doha.
Yeah, and the warning apparently came 10 minutes after the attack concluded. Look, the U.S. has its largest base in the Middle East, in Qatar. That base is constantly on high alert, given the possibility of further missile attacks from Iran. And the idea that all the sophisticated radar and anti-aircraft systems had absolutely no idea about what was coming and decided not to either, you know, if the U.S. was against this attack, the Israeli Air Force planes would have been shot out of the air like pigeons. Let's be clear about that. So the U.S. either passively acquiesced or actively supported. And I think you can take it for granted that if the Israeli attack had not failed, if it had managed to kill the Hamas negotiating team, Trump would have been the first one taking credit for it.
I do want to get into Iran, but you said earlier that I wasn't sure whether you meant that it would have been possible for the genocide to have happened with Assad in power in Damascus, or it wouldn't, because many people see the liberal elite in Western NATO countries who were all part of the supporting the moderate rebels, so-called, in Syria, are actually, and who are now opposing the genocide, were actually facilitating the genocide by supporting the overthrow of the Assad government in Syria.
During the period that Assad was still in control in Syria, Israel did not in any way feel restrained from...
Yeah, because by that time, Assad had been so weakened. I suppose the relevance of all of this, apart from your own experience on Syria, is, of course, that the next one to be taken out is Iran. Should we expect the attacks, if indeed the plan is being set up to fail, on Iran, the attack on Iran, the war on Iran, to start before the midterms on November the 3rd? And certainly that will unify the GCC, presumably behind Iran. Iran very close to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And we saw that over the past 3 years since we've been based here, contrary to the NATO broadsheet writers and journalists. Are you expecting it before November the 3rd, a full hot war on Iran from Netanyahu?
Well, I do think another Israeli attack on Iran is very likely. And those who understand Iran and Israeli-Iranian relations much better than I do feel that way. Because, you know, all the boasting and bragging about Iran having been brought to its knees and its nuclear program having been obliterated and so on is basically little more than boasting and bragging. And as other analysts have pointed out, Israel's objective in Iran is to be able to deal with Iran the same way it now deals with Syria, that basically Iran is supposed to be a defenseless nation whose skies Israel can penetrate at will and bomb whatever it likes. But I'm less certain about how this is organically related to the situation in the Gaza Strip. My sense is that Israel is determined to once again attack Iran. Israel, of course, would dearly like to do this once again in partnership with the United States, and would like to do so irrespective of whether there is genocide, war, ceasefire, or whatever in the Gaza Strip.
So what happens in Washington when they watch Israel fail to defeat Iran, as they presumably bomb Lebanon at the same time? I don't even understand why they're bombing Syria in the past few months. That's not even clear why they're doing that. But of course, they continue the bombing of Yemen. What happens to the hawks advising President Trump as they watch Israel fail in the war against Iran? Does the United States get involved?
Well, I think that you've raised one of the most interesting questions relating to the Trump administration's Middle East policy. And if you look on the left of the U.S. spectrum, their objections to U.S. Middle East policy have been very much focused on the Gaza genocide. If you look on the right, and specifically at the MAGA base, you know, people may have been opposed to the Gaza genocide, but didn't really consider it a fundamental issue. I think for many of them, the straw that broke the camel's back was not what Israel is doing in the Gaza Strip, but rather the war against Iran and what they see as Israel's successful manipulation of the U.S. to join that war, because Trump, after all, was elected, you know, on a platform of no more forever wars in the Middle East and so on. And so these people on the right see Israel as being the main agent of Trump breaking a fundamental promise to his base. And so you now have a real split within the MAGA movement and within the Trump administration of, on the one hand, you know, the neocons, the Christian Zionists, the interventions, Iran hawks, and so on. And on the other, a significant non-interventionist constituency. How that's going to play out is a little unclear, but I think the non-interventionist constituency gained significant tailwind from its opposition to not only the Israeli attack on Iran, but even more importantly, the U.S. participation in that attack.
Iran has a big pipeline agreement with Qatar, it should be added. But just very briefly, obviously, any catastrophe in Iran would be a disaster for China. Just very briefly, apart from arming Iran, which Russia and China are doing, what more can they do to preemptively stop a Netanyahu attack, then aided perhaps by the United States, regardless of the MAGA base, on Iran?
Well, I think, you know, Trump is desperate for foreign policy successes. He's completely failed to achieve anything meaningful in Ukraine. In Gaza, he basically has managed to force Israel into a ceasefire and is touting this as a most important breakthrough in diplomatic history for the last 3,000 years. And so I think Russia and China, but just as importantly, the GCC states could work in concert to use their influence and leverage with Washington, not only to ensure that there isn't another Israeli war on Iran, but also to present a reasonable and achievable diplomatic resolution. Because as you know, both the United States and Iran are in principle willing to reach a diplomatic agreement. The problem is that the United States is demanding terms from Iran that no sovereign government is prepared to accept, or in my view, should accept.
Moin Rouhani, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU armed genocide across Palestine. We'll be back on Monday with a US State Department official who quit in protest over one of Washington's wars of aggression. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.